The eyes of the CIA, in the form of satellites specially detailed for the operation, were very much upon the holy warriors as they continued on their way. Only the green tubes offered an evidentiary link to their American suppliers. They carried with them a map of the target area drawn so artfully as to resemble a quick Mujahid scroll, but actually derived from the subtlest of American satellite photographs. The sketch depicted the best approach and escape routes from the airfield at the Soviet garrison in Jalalabad. This was approximately the same spot where, 144 years earlier, Dr. Bryden had struggled alone along the Kabul road, bringing the appalling news that he was the lone survivor of the British Expeditionary Force that had ridden into Afghanistan 10 months earlier to take control of Kabul. The grisly story of Dr. Bryden and the fate of the 19th-century British invaders was told over and over again with great pleasure by U.S. ambassadors and CIA men once the Afghans started to look as if they might actually defeat the Soviets. Bryden had been part of the proud British Indian Army that had marched into Kabul with their fine uniforms and lethal weapons to install their own king. After more than a year of being hacked away by snipers and attackers, the British realized they had no choice but to withdraw. They thought they had negotiated an agreement of safe passage for their troops and dependents. But from the first day of retreat, the mountain men began to take their revenge, cutting off sections of the column, destroying the infidels one by one, as often as possible in the most horrible manner. Dr. Bryden's good fortune is assumed to be the consequence of an old tactic of Muslim warfare, to leave behind one man to tell the tale. And so the doctor carried the message that would echo down through the centuries of the fate that awaits any future enemy of the faith. Rafar stood proudly in the tradition of his Afghan ancestors. It was about 3 p.m. on September 26, 1986, when he and his men approached the Jalalabad airfield. They moved in closer to the landing zone than their ISI trainers running off the CIA target studies had specified. Until this moment, the three-man crews that flew the Hinds had never really known fear. Never in the 6 years of the war. They could kill at will, and no one could kill back. But now, preparing to pierce that invulnerability, Engineer Rafar sighted his shouldered weapon, and he and his fellow soldiers looked out near dusk at four Hinds flying into Jalalabad. To explain the functioning of a Stinger is demanding, just as it takes far more time to explain how a clock works than it does to teach a person that the clock's purpose is to tell time. Engineer Rafar may not have known what electrical forces cause the Stinger's warhead to launch out of its tube, or what makes it turn and twist in the air in pursuit of its target. That sort of detail was between the weapons designer and Allah. But he did know that the Stinger was what the Americans call a fire-and-forget weapon. Somehow, with its infrared sensors, it could chase through the skies seeking heat from the exhaust of the Hinds' engines. For Rafar, the task was to lock the beast in the Stinger's sights and then pull the trigger. There was one more thing, something the instructors had not taught the Afghans, but that none ever forgot. As the missile rocketed past Rafar's eyes at 1,200 miles per hour, he uttered the cry of the faithful, Allahu Akbar, God is great. But now the engineer's faith was put to the test, because the Stinger had misfired, and three of the Hinds were closing in. At CIA headquarters that day, Mike Vickers was nowhere to be found. He had by then left the CIA. For Avrakatos, returning from the front a few months earlier, the news that his irreplaceable strategist had decided to quit had been traumatic. Avrakatos was not one to become dependent on anyone, but over the course of just a year and a half, Vickers had become Gust's right hand, his tutor, his troubleshooter, his counselor on all aspects of the war. Vickers had taught Avrakatos to look at the big picture and not get caught up in the details or panic at temporary setbacks. He had created an entirely new vision of how to arm and train this mass of primitive individualists, and already they were transforming themselves into a force that could torment and defy the invincible Red Army. It was Vickers who had taught Avrakatos that his own instincts had been right. The Afghan war was winnable. But it was also Vickers who had given Avrakatos the shock of his life by showing him that the monetary price for getting into the winning game was far, far higher than he or anyone else at the CIA could have imagined. Early on, Avrakatos decided that Vickers was a military and tactical genius, and that he would let him call the military shots. as he backed his strategist's brash plan to build the largest operation the CIA had ever run, Avrakatos came to rely on an almost unreal aspect of Vickers's performance. He didn't seem to make mistakes. In early 1985, when the program had hit a $500 million a year and a nervous John McMahon had called in the Pentagon to review the strategy, the Joint Chiefs could find nothing to criticize. When the White House had become alarmed about corruption charges and had ordered a full policy review, Vickers had managed to turn the exercise on its head. He'd not only put down the corruption concerns, he'd also successfully argued that the president should abandon the old bleeding policy and sign off on a new U.S. policy to drive the Red Army out by all means available. In February 1986, as Avrakatos sat contemplating life without his strategist, he realized that he had bet the store on Vickers, and he had never once been disappointed. He now realized that he loved this young man, this bright, hard-working, patriotic, ethnic kid who reminded him of what he had been like when he'd first joined the agency in the early 1960s. Vickers wasn't burdened with quite the same rough edges that Gust had brought with him from Aliquippa, but still he was an ethnic, and Gust had found it rewarding to see how the kid flourished when given the right kind of assignment by the right kind of boss. It was as if he had been proving what Gust might have been able to do for the agency and for his country, had he been given the same chance that Archie Roosevelt's prep school roommate would have had. For Avrakatos, the idea of running the Afghan program without Vickers was like being told he had to have an arm amputated. He felt almost betrayed, or perhaps abandoned. At a time when the press was still predicting defeat and ruin, and before Vickers's new mix of weapons and training and theories had been given a chance to kick in, their guide and all-important strategist was just walking out. Bert Dunn got into the act, offering to make sure that after the Afghan program, Mike would get an assignment to whatever overseas post he wanted. But by then, Vickers had analyzed his situation and reached several surprising conclusions simultaneously, all of which told him it was time to leave. His first conclusion was typical of this wildly confident intellect. Vickers told Gust that his work was basically done. It would be another year or two before the full impact of what they had set in motion would surface on the battlefield, but the weapons decisions had all been taken, the contracts let, the training programs developed, the logistical system and delivery schedules established. He had put it all into the task force plans, and for all practical purposes, the rest of the CIA's efforts could go on automatic pilot. It was hard for Avrakatos to accept this until Vickers began to break it down for him. While Gust had been in Pakistan, Vickers explained, he had put into place the last major element of the weapons program, the Stinger training and deployment strategy. He was confident that the Stinger would add a lethal new dimension to the anti-aircraft mix that was already beginning to pay off. He had gone to great lengths to make sure the Afghans would be properly trained. In the past, U.S. trainers had taught the Pakistanis how to use new weapons, and the Pakistanis had then instructed the Mujahideen. This time, Vickers proposed that the American specialists go into the camps dressed like Mujahideen to personally supervise the training. He was also hopeful about the hunter-killer strategy he and Nick Pratt, the Marine colonel in charge of training, were implementing with the Stingers. Instead of using them just to counter planes or helicopters that might attack Afghan positions, the Mujahideen would be trained to take them to where they knew or suspected Soviet aircraft would be taking off or landing. The idea was to turn the tables and let the Mujahideen hunt the gunships for a change. It had worked with the SA-7s and blowpipes, but the Stinger made the strategy all the more effective. Now that the anti-aircraft strategy was in place, Vickers insisted that his master plan, spelling out precisely how the CIA should support the Afghans for the next 3 years, was complete. Had it been anyone else making this claim, Avrakatos might have doubted that such a thing was possible. But he knew better than to question Vickers. At times, Gust felt that his young military advisor was almost inhuman. "He could be frightening when he started talking numbers," Gust says. Avrakatos remembered his amazement when he'd first watched the way Vickers had gone about making his decisions about the number of rounds the Mujahideen would need to keep their AK-47s fed, factoring in not only combat engagements, but also joy shots, hoarding, and black marketeering. Including such details had become an integral part of the effortless art of Mike Vickers, allowing for life as it is on the battlefield, but applying science, discipline, and accountability whenever possible. Logistics, supply lines, medical care, such things are fundamental to war, but are particularly challenging in covert warfare. Every aspect of trying to support the Afghan holy warriors had its own special logistical challenge, and so all of Vickers's calculations had to take into account maneuvers with Swiss bank accounts, shadowy purchasing agents, safe houses, phony corporations, contracts, lawyers, disguised boats, fleets of trucks, trains, camels, donkeys, mules, warehouses, disguised satellite targeting studies, and secret payments to the families of the fighters.